speaking. We should proceed. I have an introduction that I have to make for the record, and then we'll just ask questions. Here's the kinds of questions I ask, but you and I have exchanged emails on the subject matter that you'd like to talk about, so we can probably disregard most of that. All right, let me see if I can say a few words so I can see if they're picking you up.
1, 2, 3.
This is an interview of Richard B. Smith, former commissioner of the Securities and Exchange Commission, being held at the office of Davis Polk & Wardwell in New York City on June 19th, 2002, at approximately 2 p.m. The interviewer is Richard Rowe of the SEC, or of the Historical Society. Dick, you were commissioner from 1967 to 1971.
Correct.
How did you come to the SEC? What got you interested in being a government servant for 4 years?
Well, as a lawyer, I'd always thought it was appropriate, and I always wanted to give some years in public service, and I had an opportunity at one stage in my career for a judicial clerkship, and at another stage assistant U.S. attorney, and I had already started a family, and I just couldn't afford those things at that time, and then when there was a search during the Johnson administration for a Republican commissioner to replace Barney Woodside, who had his term had expired and he had resigned, he wanted to retire. And my understanding is that the search was focused on the Northeast because of the geographical dispersion of other commissioners. And Barney, having been a Republican, it would be a Republican. And I also understood they were looking for a relatively young person. I was 36 or 37 at the time. and several people talked to me about that, lawyers who, in other firms who had considered it. I frankly thought that if there were any agency that I would go to do work would be the CAB, because I'd done a lot of airline work. I thought if I let my name be entered and Bill Carey, former SEC chairman and a good friend of mine, I think was perhaps very instrumental in my being selected. Anyway, I was selected and went down with the idea of staying 3 years. And I ended up, I think, staying up at 4.
Mm-hmm. And who were your colleagues on the commission at that time? Manny Cohen was the chairman.
Manny Cohen was the chairman. And the commissioner for whom you formerly worked, Frank Leet, was on the commission at the time. Frank and I became fastest of friends up until his death several years ago. Last year, I guess. And Hamer Budge, Hugh Owens,
that's it.
And then myself, right, yes.
Well, those were interesting times at the commission. There was an institutional investor study going on, I believe.
That was later.
Later.
That was later. That was something that Congress enacted, and Manny Cohen was chairman, and Manny actually selected the staff just before he left the commission. Which I think would have been uh, would have been 69.
Mm-hmm. But you were there for the study?
Yes, yes, yeah. And Hamer Budge, who became chairman, asked me to be the commissioner overseeing that. And and it was an interesting experience. I think one of the reasons that I was asked to do that, and I think Manny had that in mind as well, was that I was an early advocate of more presence of economists at the commission. And I myself felt when I arrived at the commission that my own lack of background in economic analysis, and I thought it was an aspect of securities regulation that was under attended to. And indeed, while Manny was chairman, I persuaded him, and there was organized an economic advisory council, and had some interesting people on it. And when the institutional investor study was authorized, the idea was it was to be basically an economic study as distinct from a lawyer study, although not to exclude lawyers. And so the basic group were economists, most of whom had, none of whom had had any prior regulatory experience. And the economists at that time were mainly econometricians and utilized statistical analysis to a great extent. And I think one of the difficulties of the study was that the SEC itself was not at that time geared for heavy-duty statistical analysis and stuff. And I think the study, the economists in the study relied on the SEC computer support people, which were quite new at the time, and the equipment was fairly new, and it was an early stage of computer-driven analyses. Which was a problem for the study. But I think the study had more to do to getting to competitive commission rates and so on than it's been given credit for. And it was also the background for the concept of a central market system as distinct from the then prevailing doctrine of competing markets.
And the study also led to, didn't it, to the 1970 amendments to the Investment Company Act?
No, the 70 amendments preceded the study. They grew out of a study that was conducted within the commission, public policy implications, PPI or something like that, that was completed before I arrived at the commission. And my first 2 years at the commission, a lot of attention was being given, particularly by Manny, to getting the legislation that was eventually enacted in 70.
Well, the economists at the commission have always been taken a back seat to the lawyers, it seems to me, over the years. I think the current chairman professes to want to get more economic input, more professional input and analysis than one can get from lawyers, or most lawyers at least.
Right. No, I think that's true. I think it's logical that the SEC would be a predominantly lawyer enterprise because of its enforcement responsibilities. I think too often rules and regulations have been adopted without sufficient attention to economic study. That's improved considerably. I mean, the Congress has also come to the view, as the Institutional Investor Study recommended, that there would be an economic staff at the Commission, and it's become more, but it certainly isn't staffed the way the Federal Reserve Board is.
No, and they're also, the Commission's also now required by statute to do cost-benefit analyses.
Right.
Although I must say some of the numbers that they come up with are interesting, to say the least.
Yes, yeah. The cost-benefit analysis is a very worthwhile concept. I've done a lot of work in that subject, apart from my life at the SEC, since leaving the SEC. The great benefit of it is that to the extent that costs and benefits can be quantified, it reduces the unexplored open area that necessarily is involved.
You mentioned that the institutional investor study laid the groundwork for, I guess, eventually freeing up commission rights. But while you were on the commission, if I recall, there were fixed commission rights.
Well, up until March, I left in June. And in March, the commission reached a decision to go competitive. It's an interesting background to that. The staff conducted negotiations with what was then called the Cost and Revenues Committee of the New York Stock Exchange to reduce commissions at the high end. And virtually simultaneously, or in the same general time period, proposed a rule, which was then called 10b-10, to require investment companies to recapture commissions, not for the benefit of sellers of investment funds, which is how it had been done, but for the benefit of investors in the funds. I dissented from the proposal rule 10b-10. I was the sole dissenter because I, to me, it made no sense if there were problems with the high end of the commission rate structure. By the high end, I meant for large share purchases and sales. It was a problem not just for investment companies, but for banks and pension funds and other institutions, or other large foundations, other large investors, and there shouldn't simply be a requirement on investment companies because they were directly regulated by the commission to affect the commission rate structure. It should be addressed formally. And then he was, I think, initially a little annoyed about my dissent, but then decided, well, we will then address the commission rate structure, and so the commission rate hearings were established, in which the Justice Department intervened. And when it came to decision-making time after those hearings, a number of which I sat in on, I had always thought, to me, the question was, how do you justify fixed rates? The only justification I could think of in the American economy was that such as common carriers and public utilities had, or yet competition, and or telephone companies, and those were all based upon requirements for large fixed capital. And wherever something could be competitive, why, that was left to the antitrust laws and competition. So the question in my mind had been, despite wonderful people who had been chairman and commissioners over the years, I could not understand myself the theory on which those commissions were fixed. And as you know, back then, you know, if you had a 10,000 share order, it was just 100 times the price of 100 share rate. I let people know and that there had to be, to me, some valid theory and on which some standards on which the reasonableness of the rates could be judged outside of just individual negotiations. I said, unless that, they would have to be competitive. And when it came to a vote, I think it was, I think there were only three of us there at the time. And I said that I thought that to transist all at one time to competitive rates would be too much of a sudden change, and that we ought to start with something larger. I think initially we said $50,000. Later we adjusted that to $500,000, but there was no way in which one could say that the rates, say, for a Donaldson Lufkin, a Morgan Stanley, or a regional member of, Rauscher Pierce, there was no way in which they were all such different capital structures and so on. You couldn't, there was no standard that one could fix. And I recognized at the time that, you couldn't have a rate structure that was partially competitive and partially fixed. And so it was to be a transition. Took a lot of heat, a lot of phone calls when that decision was made. But we stuck to it. Hamer left the commission, and Bill Casey, I think, succeeded him, and then Casey left the commission, and Ray Garrett came in, and I think the level at which competitive rates existed was reduced. And then at the end, during Ray Carrot's administration, the whole structure became competitive. But the process really began back in 71.
Well, that wasn't your only dissent at the commission, was it?
No.
I seem to remember that there was an administrative proceeding against a brokerage firm where the alleged conduct was a violation of what was then Rule 10b-6.
Yes, that's the one that I'd forgotten about and which you reminded me of, Jaffe and Company, and I since got it out to refresh my recollection, and you're right. And I also remember that was in, early on, I think. It would have been in... It was April of 70. And the question there was to what extent 10b-6 should be applied to market makers who were buying shares. The doctrine that the commission there espoused was that if anything that was in a 33 Act registration was per se a distribution for 10b-6 purposes, 10b-16, and I didn't agree with that, as my dissent said, and then about 3 or 4 years later, the commission reached a different result and even said they were now agreeing with my dissenting opinion. And I remember that Phil Loomis, who succeeded me on the commission, called me to say that they had reached a decision that was being published that day, and I should look for it. I'd be very pleased about it.
Well, that must have made you feel good.
There were three different adjudications that I remember from my days at the commission. One was the one you refreshed me on, Jaffe. A second was Michigan Consolidated, which was under the Public Utility Holding Company Act. And Frank Wheat and I wrote the opinion, but Frank joined in it, and Hugh Owens concurred in the result. He had a different basis. And Hamer Budge, who was then the chairman, dissented. That would have permitted a public utility that was a subsidiary of a holding company in Michigan to invest in and do minor investing in a entity that was organized under the National Housing Act to rebuild some of the housing in the central Detroit depressed areas. One year later, the commission reversed itself and Sid Herlong and Jim Needham had been added to the commission, Hugh Owens and I dissented on the same basis we had decided the same issue the year before, but that then reversed. The problem was the tension between these strictures in the Holding Company Act from diversifications, investments that were not utility related. But anyway, that was one opinion where I was in the majority and then later it was overturned. And the other opinion I remember was my concurring opinion in Investors Management, which I don't know, but I think I was the only SEC commissioner who was actually quoted in a United States Supreme Court opinion, the Dirks opinion. Justice Powell quoted from my opinion. But I was, Investors Management was an interesting case. It was a follow-through on the Merrill Lynch case involving Boeing. And it was a case that was brought involving a lot of the institutional investors as TIPPs. And it was an administrative case. And it was decided by the examiner, and none of the parties, neither the division nor the any other parties, appealed it. But as you know, the commission can bring examiner's opinions up, and I argued strongly to have the opinion brought up so that we could do something that I hope would become authoritative on insider trading questions. And it was brought up, and it was one of the last things I did at the commission, my concurring opinion, which, I had some effect on the majority opinion in that, you know, the opinions are drafted by an opinion writing staff, and there have been commission opinions. I mean, Kay Roberts was in fact written by Chairman Carey, and there have been various opinions written by commissioners, but mostly it's done by the staff and it's reviewed and commented on by commissioners. But it's a separated staff that has no contact at all with the enforcement divisions. And uh, I disagreed with some of the analysis, but concurred in the result in Investors Management. And I had hoped that that would be the guiding light to the staff thereafter, but it turned out not to be. So the staff was reversed repeatedly, I think, in later cases. I still think it's the right form of analysis, but...
During your tenure, there was a back office crisis on Wall Street.
Yes, I think that was the most telling part of most. I gave more thought and attention to that than anything else. I think all of us did. It was a very troublesome part. I think at one time there were something like 17 major firms on private order. Because of the chaos in the back office with all this paper around. I gave two speeches during that period, each of which were published in the Business Lawyer, one called A Piece of Paper and then A Piece of Paper Revisited. Advocating changes that we did a lot of work on the legislation that eventually became the SIPA, the Security Investor Protection Act. We did a lot of supportive work in the creation of DTC, Depository Trust Company. I had advocated the elimination of stock certificates at one point. And I think that the mutual decision between the industry and the commission was that it rather than approaching it that way was to immobilize certificates, and which is what DTC does, since the essence of DTC is electronic transfer of ownership. And a lot of my practice after I left the commission, I was on the drafting committee to revise Article 8 of the UCC, which is kind of a follow-on because the way in which securities were held and transferred was totally different from when I arrived at the commission in 67 and 78 to what it is today. And it was one of the few areas where the banking industry and the securities industry decided they had to work together and find a solution. I think our so-called back office systems are quite good now and reliable.
Yeah, now the holdup is get the legal opinion to permit restricted shares to be transferred.
That's right, and that's another interesting thing. When Frank Wheat left the commission, do you remember when? It would have been about 69?
I think that's right, because I left for a year in 69, and Frank wasn't there when I got back in 70.
I think he left in 69 because he was there my first 2 years and then was gone the next 2 years. But he finished the Wheat Report, and so I had always felt it we wanted to get the basic stuff that he had recommended adopted, and that was a principal effort I had too during those last 2 years. At the same time, there was a lot of pressure for the publication of no action letters, which I was in favor of, but to me it never made sense that there would be particular firms that did a lot of work at the SEC that got no action letters, and they knew what the law was, and it wasn't generally known, so that didn't make any sense. At the same time, the doctrine was that you had to spell out changes of circumstances and give a lot of private details about you know, marital situations or, you know, financial problems in order to persuade the staff that there was a bona fide change of circumstance that permitted you to sell what would otherwise be restricted. And I connected those two things. And I resisted the publication of no action letters unless and until that was changed, which was one of the basic Greek recommendations, that you didn't, you know, there was a bright line after which you could sell. You didn't have to go through all this change of circumstance analysis. And
I remember that there was one chief counsel of the Division of Corporation Finance that said death is not a change of circumstances because it's foreseeable.
Oh, there were so many crazy doctrines involved with that. And I was using it, in a way, as a pressure point to get the rules. We changed some of the things from the Wheat Report, but the basic thrust of it is what we wanted to keep. And I was using this, where there was a lot of pressure on us to do the right thing, to publish. I said, but you can't publish this private detail. I said, it isn't fair. It's like giving someone a Hobson's choice. And so we did the two things virtually together, a publication of action letters, adoption of the rules that eliminated the change of circumstance for the need for spelling all that stuff out.
But now lawyers have to read hundreds of non-action letters.
that's true. That's true.
Again, the technology is there to assist them.
I think it's amazing what can be done now, and things that I can't manipulate myself on my computer, why the young associate down the hall can come in and whip it out for me. It's wonderful.
You mentioned early on that the enforcement division, how did the commission handle recommendations from the enforcement division in those days, and how did they hear the other side of the story? I mean, was it a one-sided presentation, or was it
right,
some way people...
I was really appalled by that when I first went down. Indeed, Stanley Sporkin was then... assistant director in trading and markets, and would bring enforcement cases up, and he would go on about terrible and it was I complained privately to Manny. I said you don't get a sense of what this case is about. You don't know what the issues are, and we're asked to issue investigation orders or to approve settlements. I said something more needs to be done so that we can make a reasonably informed decision and haven't been prejudging the case that ever comes up to us on an adjudication. So Manny, I think, helped to organize Stanley's presentations in a more orderly way, or got him to, led him through it, I often did not disagree at all with Stanley's feeling that something was unlawful and needed to be enforced against, but it was the manner in which it was done and the improper position. And eventually, I think, I don't know whether it was under Bill Casey, but eventually, growing out of all of that dissatisfaction, the Wells Committee was formed, and...
I believe that was under Bill Casey. But, I believe it was under
Bill
Casey.
It was done sometime after I had left. I overlapped. Bill Casey was chairman, I think, for about 4 months before I left the commission. And I welcome that, because it made a lot more sense to have as balanced a presentation to the commission before we issued an order. Or
did you have government in the sunshine when you were on?
No. To me, it is counterproductive. we used to have a wonderful, well, wonderful isn't the word, but we used to have very vigorous arguments at the commission table when there was nobody present. And, you know, Frank and I disagreed, or Manny and I disagreed, any of us disagreed, we would speak up and argue it out. I think it's untoward to have that kind of collegial discussion and arguments in front of the staff. And that's the only way it can be done now. If more than two, as I understand it, if more than two commissioners get together, then it's subject to the Sunshine Act. And while a lot of the Sunshine Act makes sense, that to me doesn't. And I think that one of the proofs, why have five commissioners? You have five commissioners so that you get a balanced judgment. And if someone disagrees about something, there's no chance to discuss it. You have to write a dissent. I mean, sometimes you have to write a dissent. But there were a number of times while I was at the commission that I either persuaded the majority of the commission to see things my way, or I was persuaded to see it the other way. When there was disagreement, and there was, I thought, a useful institutional sense that one would dissent or write a separate opinion only where you really felt strongly and that the issue really mattered, and that on the whole, I certainly changed my views in the course of discussions more often than I dissented during my period there, and that was because we could have these collegial discussions. And I think the process suffers from not being able to do that anymore.
Well, you could also, I suppose, meet informally. I mean, it didn't have to be the five of you around the table. It could be two or three having lunch together discussing something.
Yes, my understanding is, though, that if you have, say, three commissioners who get together and discuss an issue together, that's subject to the open meeting.
I believe it is now.
Yeah,
but
now.
And I think something is lost there, too. Because
oh, absolutely. And that's what I... at that time, yes, we had meetings of smaller groups, but usually we like the five of us to be there and be present for the discussion, for the arguments, and we did that. You know, we just asked the staff to clear out, and we would have our
executive session.
Executive session, right? And I thought that was healthy and appropriate, because anything you decided then was a matter of public record. It wasn't as though it. What was the Wilsonian doctrine of covenants secretly negotiated, but covenants published, something that to that effect. That's not the quote, but it's the idea is that while you're negotiating something, you can't do that in a public forum. But once you decide something, it has to be immediately made public.
Well, we've been discussing weighty matters. Were there less weighty matters, matters of humor?
I was not one of those New Yorkers who disliked Washington or one of those Republicans who disliked the government. I very much enjoyed the 4 years there, and I enjoyed living in Washington. There were very good times. I was there during the period when Martin Luther King was assassinated, and there were serious riots in Washington. I remember getting calls from friends in New York, you know, are you safe and what's wrong? And I drove in the morning after that right through this area and got to the office and went on as though nothing, you know, it wasn't affected by the rioting. And it amused me because there were so many concerns from non-New Yorkers about safety in New York, you know, and how it just indicates the power with which the media can affect one's view of a whole large city because of troubles in one part of it. Not a happy time. We had bomb threats during that time. We had a system, I assume they still do, where a commissioner was kind of officer of the day, she'd say. And I was officer of the day, I had a luncheon scheduled for downtown. And mid-morning, a D.C. police came in and said there was a bomb threat against our building. And there had been one the week before as well, and the building was emptied, and they searched and found nothing. And it's apparent that, you know, people like to see an effect they can have, even though there isn't. And so they said it is your. I said, well, what do you recommend? That we clear the building? And they said, that's for you to decide. And I said, well, how am I going to decide that? I don't have the kind of information that you do. And he said, we have nothing more than a phone call. Said, we have dogs and policemen going through the building now. And he said, but you have to decide whether to do it. So I canceled my luncheon because I said, well, we're not going to abandon the building. We're going to stay in the building. And I said, I just hope to hell there's no bomb here. But I said, I'm not going to be away from the building during this period. So I canceled my lunch, and there was no bomb. They went through the building. And I assume that sort of process still goes on down.
Where I remember a number of bomb threats and some evacuations of the building. So I guess actually the Denver office did have a bomb actually go off.
Oh, really?
Later.
Where?
In the Denver regional office.
In the Denver office? Hmm.
Some years after you left.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the men's room.
In the men's room.
It wasn't a very large bomb, but it was enough to...
Probably some mining stock operator. Well, is there anything else that I don't think I would have been happy staying in the government myself. I like private practice too much, but I certainly thought it was one of the most interesting and fulfilling periods of my life, those 4 years that I spent down there.
And you actually
created
spent more
some wonderful than, friendships through it.
You actually spent more time than most commissioners do, I think.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm. I don't think that the average
is 4 years?
Tenure is anywhere near 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
There were also issues relating to shareholder proposals and the Medical Committee for Human Rights and the Dow Chemical case.
Yes, Section 14 of the 34 Act and the shareholder proposal rule, 14A8, is that it?
Yes.
Yeah. It's been quite some time since I had reason to refer to that. I think it was the NADA group who wanted to have a proposal put in a General Motors proxy statement. This was before the case you mentioned.
Yes.
And we decided
campaign GM.
Campaign GM. and we decided to permit it under, but in a way that was quite different from what the Native proposal was. We caused them to reframe it as a kind of a recommendation as distinct. Back on?
Talking about campaign GM.
Right, right, yes. Don Schwartz was involved in that. There are very few things that Don and I really agreed about, I must say, but we did agree on that Michigan Consolidated case. He wrote a law review article about that one. I think he was appreciative of the positions that I took on the stockholder shareholder proposals with respect to campaign GM. And we did a lot of fussing with the shareholder proposal rules for proxy statements all during my tenure there, attempting to refine it in a way that gave an appropriate vent to shareholder voices, but without compromising the basic responsibility of the board of directors once it was elected to manage the affairs of the company. And I think it went through many more changes after I left the commission as well. And I think there were public hearings on it at one point at which I was asked to testify. I remember preparing a long paper on the subject. So that's come a long way, and I think in the current environment, I suspect it's going to be liberalized even somewhat more.
There was a doctoral candidate at Albany Law School. He's written a dissertation and is writing a book on the.
Yes, on the yes, he sent me a draft of that.
You're treated very well in that.
Yeah, well,
as am I.
As are you as well, right? It was too long for me to read all the way through, but I read parts of it, and he interviewed me too for a while, and it was interesting to me. It's one of the few non-lawyers to have a sufficient interest in the SEC to write about it. Connection with that, one of the things that I like to think back upon was my effort to increase the role of economists at the SEC, and somehow knowledge of that became known, and I think I was the first SEC commissioner and lawyer to be asked to speak at the annual dinner of the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is a totally economist organization. And I think I was the last as well.
Well, can you think of anything else you'd like to...
I applaud this the organization of the Historical Society and their interest in trying to get some sense of the old fogies who were there, and so I appreciate driving come to ask me to say a few words, and if there's anything more or further that occurred to you after this that you'd like me to respond to, I'd be glad to do so. I have a continuing interest in one aspect that, and that was the commission historically and a special study that preceded my years at the commission. I had this concept of competing marketplaces. Of course, the Institutional Investor Study began to come to the view that was a wrong model. And what we really needed was a central market system with competition within it, as distinct from separate marketplaces competing with each other, which I thought led only to lowering standards and to a dispersion. I mean, to me, the market model ideal should be that all buying interest and all selling interest is present in the same substantial market. That doesn't mean you have to have one physical marketplace. Doesn't mean you have to have a specialist system. But I think that the Institutional Investor Study transmittal letter, which I drafted and signed, and Hugh Owens was a senior commissioner at the time, and he asked me to sign it, was the first official declaration by the commission that a central market system that utilized modern technology was the model that should be, and that was reflected in the 75 amendments that grew out of the Institutional Investor Study recommendations, although I think the Congress had conducted its own study after the Institutional Investor Study, so that it was probably more a direct result of that than the other, but the idea came from the transmittal letter. And and I sometimes worry today that this visible presence and effect of all buying interests and all selling interests in a market is being lost sight of. At least it doesn't play as dominant a role as it had from 1970 to within the last several years. And I hope that when the problem of how you deal with internet, e-trade, things like that gets resolved, that it will continue to insist on the publication and centralizing of information about not just quotes but transactions.
Well, now we have the phenomena of marketplaces going public, becoming profit-making institutions, which...
Of course, in a sense, that's existed in the prior. You know, the value of a seat on the exchange is a way of... they're transferable. They have to be... The new person has to be approved. Major elements in the market, such as the major securities firms, are publicly owned. Indeed, that was another development that I didn't mention that occurred during my years there, and that was when I first came to the commission, membership on the New York Stock Exchange, you couldn't have institutional memberships and you couldn't have public ownership.
Yeah, I remember Jeffries left the New York Stock Exchange membership just because of that.
And Donaldson Lufkin came down to the commission to try to get permission to sell subordinated debt as a first publicly in itself. And I very much supported it because, to me, one of the weaknesses of the securities industry at that time, which was becoming evident with the back office crisis and the problems of accurate accounts, was that there was very little capital in this industry. Some of the block positioners had capital, but most of the firms it was a, they were partnerships, and they were, the money was taken out. They kept in just enough as operating capital.
Like a law firm.
Pardon?
Like a law firm.
Yes. And but so that there wasn't any real capital there, and I at the time asked, you know, well, why are you just asking for debt? Why not equity as well? And I said, in order to get a permanent capital structure. And of course, eventually that happened, but it began with that Donaldson Lufkin. But you can see the banks had massive capital. They were all incorporated. J.P. Morgan, a lot of private banks were members of the exchange that left the exchange for that reason, in order to build capital and to incorporate. So that was another. There have been many, many changes since the days when I went down there. I remember when I first went down there, all initial public offerings came to the commission for order. And
I remember you rewriting some front pages of some perspectives.
And I got into that too deeply, and I know in retrospect that was not a good use of a commissioner's time, but it was what I knew, and I suppose I was simply reflecting that. And I always felt that the writing of a prospectus was an important. An important thing. It was sort of my early premonition of the idea of what became known as plain English, although I didn't care much about plainness, but I did think it was important to describe and write about something in an intelligible way. And some disclosure documents, prospectuses, were just in terrible condition. But anyway, I think that lasted about a year, less than a year, and even I recognize that this stuff should all be delegated. We have more vital things or crucial things to concern ourselves with. So I think the first year as a commissioner is very much a learning experience, and why I think 2 years is too short, because one should repay the education one gets the first year in some way.
Well, unless you have something else, Dick, I thank you on behalf of the Society, and the interview's over.
Thank you very much.